You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In this month's federal election, Stephen Harper tarred the cultural community with the accusation that they indulged themselves in extravagant galas at public expense. This smear backfired, particularly in Quebec, and it was one important reason his hope for a majority government failed. But when it comes to real extravagance at public expense, namely the billions spent on waging war on the people of Afghanistan, until recently there's been a deafening silence. How much money has this campaign of conquest and occupation cost Canadians? To explore this question, we've contacted Steve Staples, president of the Rideau Institute in Ottawa. He is co-author of a recent Rideau Institute paper titled The Cost of War and the End of Peacekeeping. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
So in the 7 years since Canada began its war on the people of Afghanistan, has any government or parliamentary committee provided a precise, transparent figure of the financial costs?
It's been left to a lot of people to try to figure out the cost based on what was available from the various reports on plans and priorities released by the Department of National Defense, which have gives us a little bit of a view in terms of how much cost is, how much money is being spent on this. But there has never been a fully costed, comprehensive number put forward by the government in the time that we've been there. What happened was that in the absence of this information, the NDP member for Ottawa Centre, Paul Dewar, asked the newly established Parliamentary Budget Office that was set up as a result of the new Accountability Act to devote their first study to putting a comprehensive cost, government-wide cost, to the war. And that report was put out just recently and sort of capped off some other estimates, one that was put out by the Rideau Institute and other academics as well, too, to give the first authoritative government number.
So, for instance, when we were votes were taken to extend our war making, like there was one in 2009, and then first to 2009 and then to 2011, were those decisions made without examination of the financial cost as well?
Well, this is what's really astounding, is that these members of Parliament were making these decisions without fully understanding the cost of those decisions, and they were only getting scraps of information. My understanding, secondhand, but when was that the government at one point put out one figure, but provided no full accounting as to what was included in that number. And when the Parliamentary Budget Officer finally did his study, he found that whatever numbers had been given out previous to that were woefully inadequate. So it's quite clear that members of Parliament made a decision to extend the war in this last vote, where the Liberals voted with the Conservatives to extend the war by 3 years to December 2011, without having any idea at all how much they were actually spending. When in fact, we now know that that vote probably cost in the range of about $7 billion. That was a $7 billion decision to extend the war.
Wow, extraordinary. Now, you mentioned Kevin Page's estimate a while ago. So we've had estimates from $8 billion to your own estimate of 28. What sense are we to make of estimates that range so widely?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at the methodology fairly closely. And as an organization like the Rideau Institute that's done a lot of study on defense spending overall, there are different methodologies that can be used. The military itself uses different ways of measuring. NATO uses three different ways of measuring military spending. So you have to sort of adjust what each time you get an estimate, you have to adjust to get the same, so to make sure you're comparing apples to apples. Our own study, Peter, found that government spending on the war, when you include the cost to the Department of National Defense, when you include the costs of through CETA, which is the foreign aid and development portion of it, and as well, and this is new, when you include the cost of health care for all of the wounded, hundreds of wounded soldiers who are coming back, our numbers came to just a little bit over $20 billion, costing it out all the way to December 2011. and that includes the cost of soldiers' salaries. Now then, based on some of the methodology done in the U.S., for instance, we added on a cost to the families and the economy and the communities from the soldiers who are no longer able to work or who were killed, and that cost is an extraordinary additional $7 billion. So it's about $21 billion cost to the government, full cost, plus $7 billion to the economy, and that's how we came up to the $28 billion figure. Now, Kevin Page, the parliamentary budget officer, put forward his numbers just a day or so after ours, and his numbers came to $18 billion, as you mentioned, and that excluded the cost of the economy. So he just looked at the cost of the government, $18 billion. But what's important to note is in his figures, he did not include the cost of the 2,500 soldiers who are in Kandahar right now. So in fact, his numbers were higher than our numbers when you adjusted for methodology. And I was at Kevin Page's press conference in Ottawa when he gave his numbers, and he made it very clear that the report was incomplete. He did not get full cooperation from all the government departments in terms of the numbers that he needed to compute it, and he admitted that his numbers were probably on the low side.
Now, you in your report, you talk about private costs. What are they and how are they calculated?
Well, those are those additional costs to the lives of the soldiers that have been lost or who have been injured. And this is based on a methodology that the Stiglitz study did on the cost of Iraq in the United States. It's sad and kind of hard to imagine, but it is true that their economists are able to put a cost to a person's contribution, a cost to a person's life. It's something that insurance companies do. You know, you have to do this in terms of figuring out benefits to surviving families and costs related to injuries. It is something that's widely accepted, and it was something that we did, separated out from our studies, to show what is the impact of the loss of income that would have been earned by people had they not been injured or, in fact, lost their lives. What is the amount of that cost to the families and the communities? And so those are the private costs that are outside of the government costs, and that's why we think that's important to recognize, and we separated that out in our study. So it was $21 billion for the government costs all across the government, plus an additional $7 billion from those private costs, as you mentioned.
So now, okay, in terms of the government costs, I think you divide them into Department of National Defense and Veteran Affairs. Can you tell us a bit more about those categories and what you found in those areas?
Well, yes, of course, certainly the largest percentage of the cost is consumed by the Department of National Defense. That is a big chunk, and as I mentioned, we included the full cost of all the salaries of the troops that are involved, but and as well as the wear and tear on all the equipment, all the price of oil, the ammunition, all of these costs are assumed by the Department of National Defense. And those are some of the more common figures that we've used in the past. But recent studies, as I mentioned, in the U.S. and other studies that are now happening in Canada, are, in addition to that, including the costs incurred from all of the injured soldiers that are coming back. Now, this is very tough to figure out, and we've had to use other models in the U.S. and kind of apply them here. For one thing, the government does not reveal the number of wounded soldiers. It's very difficult to get those figures. There have been some access to information requests that have yielded some numbers. These have been published in the Globe and Mail and elsewhere. We can also look at jumps that have been incurred by the Department of Veterans Affairs that is responsible for the health care of soldiers, and by using those numbers have extrapolated the figures that would be incurred from the costs of caring for all these soldiers. And I think that's the big story, is that that we are now getting a sense of the economic impact of the human toll of the war in Afghanistan. And on top of that, we added the CETA costs for the development in the country, which are, I mean, Afghanistan is now the largest recipient of Canadian foreign aid in the realm of $100 to $200 million a year now. It just dwarfs everything else we're doing. There may be other costs as well, too. Kevin Page said there could be costs in some of the other departments, such as the RCMP. There could be other costs in foreign affairs for the diplomatic ones. But I think he probably, in his study and in ours, covered off the major portions of that. But by no means, I think it's not all of it. There's still some unanswered questions around the types of equipment, the wear and tear on the equipment, and even how much we should count of all these new aircraft, for instance, that we're purchasing, and attribute that to Afghanistan. These Afghanistan figures don't even include the billions of dollars of equipment that we're buying, but could reasonably assumed in that. So that's why these figures are probably low.
Now, when it comes to CEDA expenditures, the so-called development aid, it's been observed by many that while the budget's considerable, the specific projects are sometimes just on paper. So where does this money end up?
Well, that's a good question, and that's something that people have been trying to figure out, exactly what kind of impact is the money that we're spending, which is roughly 10 to 1 in terms of military spending to development spending. Where is this money going? And I think a lot of it is going into the international aid organizations instead of going to non-governmental organizations who might be involved. I know NGOs that are involved in the humanitarian field have complained about it, that too much of it is being driven in that direction. But now, in an effort to address those critiques that there's precious little to show for the development funds that are being poured into Afghanistan, the government has tried to take on a few high-profile signature missions, such as repairing this large hydroelectric dam, the Dala Dam, doing some road building and things like that. And they've been it's been particularly obvious, for instance, that they've been corralling some of the defense commentators who receive Department of National Defense funding, for instance, like the Conference of Defense Associations and other counterparts to the Rideau Institute on the other side. It's clear that there's been a rather coordinated strategy to try to play up a few signature aid projects. But I think it's pretty clear, everybody knows, that until we end the fighting there, end the conflict, a lot of this money that's being spent in the South is going to have very little lasting impact. I think that's why so many Canadians are focused on ending the conflict there. I don't think they are opposed necessarily to the foreign aid money that goes to Afghanistan. People are moved by the plight of the people there. But until we improve the security situation and end the conflict, I think there's little guarantee that this money is going to make any lasting impact to people's lives on the ground there.
How large a portion is the whole Afghanistan project as a part of total military expenditures?
Well, right now we're probably spending in the range of about $2.5 billion just every year on defense from the defense portion that's going to these missions. Of course, our military budget is about $19 billion a year, but I think that's understated. It's hard to imagine any aspect of defense now that is not touching, that is not involved in some way or another in Afghanistan. You think of the military equipment expenditures, for instance. We've bought 2 fleets of aircraft. Now the transport aircraft, but they're designed for long range, and it's arguably that we only bought these really because of the Afghanistan mission. Meanwhile, other aircraft needs, such as search and rescue, particularly in British Columbia, go unaddressed. There's just no momentum behind those kinds of purchases to get that going. We've also spent $1.3 billion on those Leopard tanks that have been deployed there. That's clearly an Afghanistan expense. So I think there's even more costs within the military budget that have been lost. And in terms of the opportunity costs as well, Peter, I mean, we're just not involved in UN peacekeeping anymore. Afghanistan is pretty much the only mission that the military is really focused on, apart for perhaps some preparations for the Olympics and whatnot here in Canada. But Afghanistan is really consuming the entire government effort in defense at the exclusion of any other mission.
Well, thanks very much, Steve, for shedding some light on this very complicated set of issues. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's nice to be on the show, Peter, and I just want to also, just before I go, wish you all the best of luck in the funding drive. I was very happy to have been part of Co-op Radio back in the 90s with you and on the board, and I know now on the other end, working in the policy end, how essential it is to have multiple voices, particularly in this media environment like CFRO. So I'm very happy to be with you again and support the station.
Thanks again, Steve. I've been speaking with Steve Staples, president of the Rideau Institute in Ottawa. You can go to their website for the full report, rideauinstitute.ca. And you'll also find a link on our website at corpradio.org/redeye.